in order to win, change your voice, change how you look, change what you wear, change how you speak, and everyone would have a different answer. And with running for office in politics, there's no right answer. Otherwise, we wouldn't have such intense political campaigning, you know?
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learn from them. I'm your host, Ozan Varol. Today's guest on the show is Nadia Okamoto. Nadia is the executive director of Period, which is at period.org, an organization that she founded at the age of 16 to provide menstrual hygiene products to those in need. Period is now the largest youth-run NGO in women's health and one of the fastest growing in the United States. In 2017, Nadia ran for office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Although she did not win, her campaign made historic waves in mobilizing young people, both on the ground and at the polls. Her debut book, which is called Period Power, A Manifesto for the Menstrual Movement, made the Kirkus Reviews list for Best Young Adult Nonfiction of 2018. And earlier this year, Nadia made InStyle Magazine's The Badass 50, Meet the Women Who Are Changing the World list, along with Michelle Obama and Ariana Grande. Today, Nadia is also the Chief Brand Officer of Juve Consulting, a Generation Z marketing agency based in New York City. You can keep in touch with Nadia and say hello to her on Instagram. Her handle is Nadia Okamoto. I'll spell that out for you. N-A-D-Y-A is her first name, and her last name is O-K-A-M-O-T-O. In the episode, Nadia and I discuss why receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award made her feel inadequate, how she stays true to herself while in the media spotlight, how she handled pushback from family, peers, and trolls during her city council campaign, how she ended up finding success in a political campaign that she ended up losing, what Nadia does to avoid spiraling into self-doubt and getting lost in negative thoughts, and how she finds balance through late-night workouts and Netflix. Before I play you the interview, if you'd like to keep in touch with me, your host, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian. It goes out every Thursday. It shares an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for other articles, books, tools, quotes, really anything that challenges conventional wisdom and helps us to reimagine the status quo. You can sign up for that by heading over to weeklycontrarian.com. And if you sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Nadia Okamoto. And thank you, as always, for listening. Nadia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to be speaking with you. So I'd love to begin with your background, because I'm always curious about why people chose the path that they are on. So tell us about how you became passionate about providing universal access to menstrual hygiene products.
I mean, I know it's not the most common thing to be passionate about, right? But I very much am. But, you know, I started my organization after my family was, you know, experienced living without a home of our own. And during this time, I had, on my way to and from school, had many conversations with homeless women who were in much worse living situations than I was in, heard their stories of using toilet paper, socks, brown paper, grocery bags, cardboard to take care of their periods, and got absolutely fascinated by it. Just kind of like obsessively started Googling things about period poverty. And after learning about the tampon tax, really decided that I needed to like take action. So I started a nonprofit.
And for those who are not familiar with the tampon tax, what is it exactly?
So it exists in 34 states now, but when I was starting in 2014, it existed in 40 states. So it's a sales tax on period products, considering them non-essential goods, so like luxury items. Meanwhile, products like Rogaine and Viagra are considered essential goods, right? So it's kind of this like, you know, unfair tax on period products, considering them, basically really showing that menstrual hygiene is considered a luxury.
And I'd love to put a pin on that and circle back to that a little bit later about what you've been able to accomplish in terms of the repeal of the tampon tax and also some of the pushback you experienced. But I want to circle back and talk to you more about the founding of Period. So you were only 16 years old, right, when you started the organization?
Yes, I started Period when I was 16.
So what were some of the challenges you encountered in starting this nonprofit at such a young age?
You know, I think a lot of it was like self-doubt. And when I was experiencing a lot of people like giggling or laughing at me when I first told them about what I was doing, I think it was a lot of them kind of giggling at me and doubting me. And I had to learn to have my own strength in saying, you know, I'm not going to listen to this. I really believe in what I'm doing.
And you've written about previously about how you experience imposter syndrome from time to time.
Oh, every day.
Yeah. So tell us more about that. Like, when is it most acute for you? And over the years, have you developed any tactics, strategies, self-talk for dealing with it?
I think it's more like denial, which is maybe not the best. I think it's like, okay, I have imposter syndrome. Ah, don't think about it. I'm just going to keep working, keep doing things. You know, I won a lifetime achievement award last week and felt like so inadequate for it. And I was like, oh, I'm 21. Like, it's all downhill from here, I guess. Like, you know, but I think my sort of solution was like, okay, I'm just not going to think about that and just like, you know, be really thankful for it. And I'm just going to keep working and all of that, you know?
Well, first of all, congratulations on the Lifetime Achievement Award. That's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
But I do think that's great advice, actually, to be able to just keep pushing forward. The other reaction that you could have had to this Lifetime Achievement Award instead of doubting yourself would have been to maybe say, oh, I'm amazing, and then boost and inflate your ego, which can lead to problems in the long term. But having a little bit of doubt in the face of the type of success you've had is actually can be a good thing.
That's what I would hope to. Yeah.
Talk to me about some of the mechanics of like how you actually started this nonprofit. Again, you were 16 years old. So how did you figure everything out?
Okay. Honestly, I get asked this question like every day, like, how did I start? And my honest answer is I don't really know. Like I started, had no idea what a nonprofit was. I Googled, what is a nonprofit? I Googled, what is the IRS? What is a board of directors? What is a Form 990? And just ended up like, just started filling out forms that, you know, that came up. I just started just doing whatever I thought seemed like the best option and just took it from there. It was same thing with running for office, writing a book, starting this company. It was just like, okay, I don't know the answer. I'm just going to go look it up, or I'm just going to try it out, and it's going to work or it's not going to work. And if it doesn't work, I'm not even going to think about it. I'm just going to try something else.
In starting and building period, did you encounter any roadblocks or failures? Since the show is about failure, I'd love to hear about that. And if there are multiple, maybe you can talk to us about one that stands out as being particularly memorable.
You know, it's interesting because when I got the invite for this podcast, I started thinking a lot about like failure and like what it means to me. And like, you know, I think that it's such a cliche. You know, all these successful people always say like, you just have to understand like that failure, like it's not an option, like it's going to happen, and you have to embrace failure and like love failure. And like, you know, you hear that from entrepreneurs
sure.
a lot.
Right.
I am not like that at all. Like I hate failure. I'm terrified of failure, but I kind of see it as like failure not being an option. Or also just seeing when you do fail, not seeing it as a failure, seeing it as like, okay, what did I learn from this? Right.
Right.
So I think two examples I would think of is like, when I was trying to apply for college, right? I was applying for college and I was really gunning for Harvard because my family was low income. We had no money for college. And I knew the only way to go really to college was to go to a place that had the best financial aid endowment that would give me an automatic full ride and resources to move in. You know, it didn't seem like an option to me. Like failure was an option if I wanted to go to college, right? What people look at me and notice as like my public failure was like running for office and losing. But for me, when I was running, it was about fighting to win, but I wasn't expecting to win. So when we didn't win, to me, it was like, you know, I see success in the fact that we made national waves with getting young people in office, that we broke records with an historic youth turnout, like tripled the voter registration for students. And now in 2019, 2 years later, the next election cycle, there's another student running, right? So I think for me, whenever that came up in life, I never want to fail. I don't want to fail. And I think when I pursue things with vigor and passion, I'm like, I'm just like, failure is not something that's going to happen.
Right.
Which is like a very stressful way to live, maybe.
Well, I think what you're doing, and maybe I can like tease out two highlights from your answer. But first of all, like, I think your account or your approach towards failure is really refreshing in this sense. So as you said, yeah, fail fast, fail often, embrace failure. Those mantras are all the rage these days in Silicon Valley. But you know, from my perspective, and I think from the perspective of probably most of the members of this audience, failure sucks. Like it's, you know, whoever says they really truly celebrate failure is probably lying to you. To be able to say like, yeah, failure sucks, but do what you did, which is to not necessarily see it as failure, but maybe a learning opportunity. So reframing failure as learning can help take some of the stigma out of it. And also, like, if you learn something from the experience, then all was not lost. So perhaps a mantra should be not to fail fast, but to learn fast. I wanted to come back to the tampon tax. I mentioned I put a pin there and I want to return to it. And so this is one of the policy initiatives that that you've championed through period. Can you tell us more about that and like the type of impact you've been able to achieve in that context? And also, I know you encountered quite a bit of pushback in trying to get this tax repealed. Perhaps you can share some of that pushback with us as well.
You know, it's hard to say who exactly owns the success of, you know, taking down the tampon tax. I would like to hope that a lot of the work we've done to raise awareness and with our chapters has helped. Like, I think that it's been really amazing to see just how many activists are taking action around this all over the country. And I just kind of want to put that disclaimer out there as well, just because I think that like this movement is so strong because there are so many people involved. In terms of the pushback we get, a lot of it is purely that people just don't agree that menstrual health products are necessities, right? And a lot of people, especially people in politics, first of all, are not menstruating cisgender women, right? Like a lot of them are non-menstruating cisgender men, you know? So when we talk to them about periods, they've never thought about this being a necessity and have no idea about how to empathize about what it's like to get your period and not have access to period products. So a lot of the work we do is simply try to raise awareness about this and also push forward empathy on like, imagine what it's like to not have period products and why it's so necessary that they're made available.
And so I'd love to dig a little bit deeper into this in terms of concrete strategies you're using to build empathy. How do you do that with the legislature?
You know, a lot of it is by sharing stories and anecdotes from people who experience period poverty. A lot of it is putting into context for them, right? Push them to go talk to their wife, their daughter, their sister about what it's like, right? Ask questions and also show them through studies and whatever else about what truly are the significant impacts of period poverty, right? The fact that 46% of low-income women in the first citywide study on period poverty in St. Louis, 46% had to choose between a meal and period products, right? And when we talk about stories like that and we bring up these stats, or that 1 in 5 women and girls miss school or work due to not having access to period products, that matters. And I think when you put it into context in the frame of like how this affects gender equality and access to opportunities overall, they understand.
And you mentioned, you know, period is one of a number of organizations working on repealing the tampon tax. How do you coordinate with other groups working on these initiatives, or do you coordinate with them?
We definitely do. And a lot of it is trying. We're actually launching a national campaign next week.
Okay.
Kind of more on this. But, you know, a lot of what we try to do is basically kind of put out the idea that, you know, we are period as an organization, but we really exist to bring more young voices into the menstrual movement. And there's so much incredible work and advocacy happening in the menstrual movement. And we, you know, not to sound cheesy, but like we're all stronger together and the importance of all of us needing to unite together. I work very closely and, you know, am rather good friends with a lot of the other activists in the community. And we try to be as coordinated about our efforts as possible. And part of what the campaign that we're launching next week actually involves, you know, building up this public coalition against period poverty.
If people want to learn about the national campaign, is there a particular website or another resource that they can go to?
Yeah, I mean, we'll put it all across our social media channels at Period Movement, so you can definitely find it there.
Awesome. Yeah. Perfect. As the menstrual movement spread across the U.S. and internationally, you became a symbol in the movement, one of the symbols of the movement. How have you handled the pressure of being in the spotlight?
This kind of makes me just sound like someone who's in a lot of denial, which my mom definitely thinks I am. But, you know, I think that my honest answer is that I don't really pay attention to like the clout that comes in. When articles are published about me or when videos come up, I'll skim them. I'll watch the videos for fact checking. I'll share it on social media, which is like part of my job, right? But I won't think of it as something that is defining my self-worth or making me a new person, right? Or becoming a part of my identity, right? I think that I go back to my identity being very much about why I do this work, right? And I think that with the public spotlight, I don't see that as an end. I see that as a means to an end. Like, I don't do my work for the press articles, but I love press articles because it helps us destigmatize periods and getting more people talking about menstruation, you know?
Right.
Like, I think that for me, and I see this a lot, like with other young activists, like sort of losing sight of like, knowing that visibility and press and, you know, this public, you know, public attention, it cannot be your end. It has to be your means to an end with advocacy. And I think that I very much remind myself of that a lot.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of reframing this because, you know, as you know, we live in a world obsessed with likes and retweets and,
yeah,
and numbers and whatnot. And a lot of people have a very difficult time of zooming out from that and not seeing it as an end. But as you said, the best way to not pay attention to that is to see it as a means to an end. So the end is something else in your case, and you've clearly defined your why. The attention you get is just a means to it, which is a very nice way of like zooming out and not being obsessed with, you know, how much press coverage you're getting or how many likes your latest post got on Instagram.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to circle back to, you mentioned you ran for office in Cambridge in 2017. Let's dig a little deeper into that. So talk to us about your thought process. Why did you decide to run?
I kind of went into it without, you know, truly thinking too much about it. But, you know, I got very passionate about housing affordability, like plain and simple, like got to Cambridge. Cambridge was a special place to me because I had sort of grown up in and out of the city with my godparents there. And, you know, got really passionate about housing affordability because I was seeing it around the city. I would run and explore around the city and find these intersections of street where I could see the gentrification. And it made me so upset because I'd never seen it so visible before. And then also kind of doing my own research and learning about like the incredible, you know, corruption and income inequality and lack of youth representation, even though like I think of Cambridge as like a college town with Harvard, MIT, Lesley. So I decided to write down my thoughts on policy and why I thought young people should be involved and kind of try getting involved. Ended up with this 80-page Word document about what I thought city council could be doing better and started bringing it to city councils and residents. And they started turning around being like, oh, if you have so many ideas, why don't you run yourself? Right. Mm. And it's, but they didn't say it as like a, you should run. They said it as a like, ah, ha, ha, you're not going to care about this in a couple of months anyways. So I think for me, like, and I was always sort of the kid, like you tell me not to do something and I'm like, let me show you, you know? And so I ended up one day just looking up, okay, what does it take to run for office? Saw that you had to be 18 and felt overqualified because I was 19 and decided to run and, you know, just figured out the steps. Okay. Download this form, get all the signatures, build a team, convince some friends to turn down like paid internships, come work with me. And we embarked and we, you know, ran an incredible campaign against, you know, 26 other candidates in a really crowded field and just believed in what we were doing, knocked on more doors than any other candidate and ran for office.
In a previous article you wrote, and I'm going to quote here, running for office was one of the most terrifying, exhausting, yet meaningful experiences of my life. There was a lot of pushback, both locally and nationally. And the hardest part was the hate we received from peers on the Harvard campus. Can you tell us more about that?
When I was running, I didn't think anyone at Harvard would care. There's such an intense town and gown relationship. First of all, everyone in city council is like, oh, Harvard students don't care. And even we'll say like Harvard students are the reason this gentrification exists, right? When I ran, I was really running to like send a message to the local community of like students should and can very easily be involved. Yeah, we got a lot of pushback, especially because I was not born and raised in Cambridge. You know, we got a lot of pushback. We got a lot of people questioning motives and everything. And, you know, when I announced and this video went up, these Harvard kids, you know, it's a very competitive campus. When it first went out, I think a lot of people were like, who do you think you are? Why do you think you can represent students? Like, you're just doing this for attention. Mm. People questioning my motives. And I think that there was also a lot of people thinking that because I was doing this, I must be so full of myself. And I think a lot of it was questioning motives, which is kind of like a theme at Harvard when like everyone, a lot of people say they want to do like finance or just consulting and everyone's questioning each other's motives. And I think that it was really tough because, I mean, I get a lot of hate for what I do, right? From, you know, trolls and whatever who say like they don't believe in what I do. And I don't give a fuck when people say like, I don't believe in period, right? Because I believe in period and I know we're making an impact and I know we're onto something. What I was very hurt by is when people question my motives, you know, because I think that that's something very important to me. And that's something that's very personal to me. And when I ran suddenly with this heightened sense of public attention, people were questioning, oh, I just did period as a stepping stone to get into Harvard and then build a profile to run for office. And I don't really care about period. Or like, oh, I'm just running for office to like get my name on the map to like become like, you know, more recognized. I don't actually care about the community and I don't actually care about the issues. And I think that was a lot of the pushback I got from students. And I think a lot of it was just like students thinking I was maybe crazy for doing this. And so I remember I would go out to parties as like a college freshman and like people would pull out their Snapchats and try to take videos and like make fun of me, like not even for city council. And like on the surface, they like kind of were joking and like being supportive, but like not supportive at all. It was like in a mocking way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that I stopped, you know, I worked nonstop. At the time, period had just hired on our full-time staff. I was working 6 jobs when I started to run because I was like trying to make money and, you know, go to school and support my family in any way that I could. And I was exhausted. And I think the drama of school and people, like even other students, were openly posting memes about me in the meme pages and, you know, making really mean comments and like writing me emails that were paragraphs and pages long about like why they didn't like me, right? Like thesis arguments, supporting evidence of why they did not like me, you know? I think that's why it was one of the most exhausting, because I had all this pushback that I wasn't expecting. At the same time, everyone who supported me was also telling me what was wrong with me, right? Like, yeah. Like there were a lot of political consultants who were literally flying out or calling me being like, we want you to win. We love what you're doing. We believe in you. In order to win, change your voice, change how you look, change what you wear, change how you speak. And everyone would have a different answer. And with running for office in politics, there's no right answer. Otherwise, we wouldn't have such intense political campaigning, you know? Right. There's no right answer. Like, no one knows what it really means to run for office. No one really knows, like, what is the perfect way to get votes, right? And so it really is about, like, having self-confidence. And I think for me, I was just so done with, like, I think exhausting in the way of, like, well, okay, to kind of back up, I said terrifying, exhausting, and meaningful. Terrifying because I never experienced this pushback. And a lot of the questions I was being asked on a daily basis, I had to figure out answers on the spot. Right. Like whether that be about like a policy that I did not know. And I had to basically, I was always proving myself that I was worthy of having a voice and a spot at the table. And I never received death threats at that level before too. Second of all, I think exhausting because I was working a lot on a school. I was canvassing 4 to 6 hours a day, and exhausting because I was so sick of hearing what was wrong with me. And meaningful because all of that taught me to just be unapologetically myself, right? Mm. Knowing that if I'm going to keep my eye on the ball, if I'm going to be productive, I have to block all this out and just focus on why I'm doing this and what I'm doing.
Because as you said, I mean, it's one thing for people to say, I don't believe in what you're doing because you do. But then to also have people actually question your motives and ascribe these like potentially selfish motives when your motive was altruistic, that must have been really, really difficult. So it taught you, you said, the experience to be unapologetic about what you're doing. But as you were going through this, is there anything that helped to keep you going? And I'm asking this from a perspective of like, if somebody else is experiencing this sort of opposition, and of course, revolutionary ideas always face opposition, what advice would you give them so they do keep going as opposed to quitting?
Let me start with like when this was happening. Everyone was giving me the advice of talk to your real friends and like talk to your family, right? And when I was running, I felt super alone because first of all, I realized who my real friends were, because when I announced I was running, even some of the best friends I had since high school suddenly weren't talking to me because they didn't believe in what I was doing, right? And they thought that this was a bad idea. None of my family was supportive when I first started running for different reasons. They thought it was like going to, you know, it'd be too exhausting and put me over the edge. They thought I was going to burn out. So I didn't have that comfort or support network. And also when I was running at school, every student was a potential voter. So I couldn't look at any of my friends and be like, I'm exhausted. I don't want to do this anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. I needed them to see that I could do this. So I think that constantly had thoughts of what the fuck am I doing? Why am I doing this? I'm so tired. And the solution was really like I would just constantly push those feelings of doubt away, because I have this tendency to like spiral and like what my therapist has called like catastrophizing, right? Mm-hmm. Where like when I start a negative thought, I will just spiral into this like deep, endless pit of negative thought. And so I think what I'm really good at is I will catch myself, be like, okay, nope, not going to do that to myself. Like, look at the impact that we are making, focus on that. What is my to-do list and how can we keep going? Right. And I mean, I do that like now in my everyday life, right? Like I constantly feel like with imposter syndrome, like I want to give up because I'm tired. Like this week has been really exhausting because we're launching this national campaign. I've slept like 4 hours every night and I'm pretty tired. And I was dumped last week by my boyfriend because I prioritize my career too much, you know? And with all of that, I spiral into these negative thoughts of like, am I doing the right thing? Am I prioritizing the right things? And then I just remember, I believe so much in what I'm doing. I believe so much in that the issues I'm fighting for are worthy issues. And then I will literally sit myself down in front of a notepad and like literally make a to-do list, like checkbox to-do list, right? Of all the things that I have to do. And I just think about like, okay, this is my purpose. And if I keep spiraling in these negative thoughts, I'm not going to get anywhere. You know, right. Like I'm just going to be sitting here pitying myself and feeling sad about myself. And I just have to take it one by one, right? Okay. First on the list, check it off, go. Like my friends know that I always carry these like loose sheets of paper around with me, just like filled with to-do lists, and I check them off. And I have so much satisfaction from doing that. And like, yeah, like I had mixed reviews on this because some of my therapists and my mom is like, this is such a bad idea because it gives you that feeling like you're never ending and then your work never ends. So you always feel tired. But like, I actually don't feel that way at all. It's like every time I check something off, I'm like, okay, I did something. Right. And like, right. And I do know that I have to reflect. Like, I'm not saying don't reflect. I'm saying like, give yourself time to reflect and don't let it like consume your day and consume your motive. Like, okay. So one of the things that I do for self-care is I work out every day. Like no matter what, I work out 30 minutes to an hour every day. The last few nights I've worked out at like 2 a.m. every day, which is like something I should probably start doing. But I have a gym downstairs. I'll go out. I'll work out. Last night I worked out from like 2 to 2:30 a.m. And I post on Instagram about it because I just feel like it holds myself accountable to like show that I'm doing this. But I work out every day. And when I'm working out, I don't do any work. I watch Netflix. I listen to music. And that's where I can start thinking a little bit more about like, you know, some of those more negative thoughts or like those more self-critical thoughts. But while I'm doing the act of like self-strengthening and improvement. And I think that that's something that's kept me really balanced and like have a reality check while also not letting it like consume me.
Yeah, that's great advice. So whenever you find yourself sort of spiraling down, as you said, into this canyon of despair, the goal is to first notice what you're doing. And then, and this actually takes us back to the beginning of the conversation, but to zoom out and actually check your why again, like, why am I doing this? And one of the things you said at the very beginning of our conversation, when you said you deal with imposter syndrome on a daily basis, is that the way that you get over it or keep it at bay is to just keep pushing forward. And making to-do lists is one version of that, right? Like you create these concrete to-do items, you put them down on paper and you start doing them and you can start checking them off. And that gives you a sense of momentum, a sense of forward progress, which then you can use to keep going. But as you said, it is important to then check in with yourself to make sure that you're not like completely neglecting these feelings and doubts about yourself. And it sounds like you do that when you're working out, which is great.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time here, Nadia, but I want to give you the opportunity. If you have any parting words for the audience, please let us know anything like we should have talked about, but we did not. And also let us know if people are interested in finding out more about you and about Period, where they can find you online.
Yeah, for sure. So I would say the just kind of final note is that I think that another thing is just like staying really humble about what you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think that something I always see with, you know, young activists or leaders or entrepreneurs is it's really easy to get a big ego, you know? And I think that something that has kept me really going and in check is just knowing, like recognizing how much I don't know and how much I have to learn, right? And I think that that's why I have so many incredible mentors and why we've gotten so far, because I really ask questions and acknowledge what I don't know. If you want to find out more about Period or connect with me, I'm just at Nadia Okamoto on social media or at Period Movement on social media. That's kind of what I'm working on, along with Juve Consulting, which is a Generation Z marketing agency here in New York.
Excellent, Nadia. Thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.